Accession number 28528, Real 8.
Penny Pawson, Real 9.
Sorry, I've forgotten how I ended it. So I go on. The only other problem was the swarms of mosquitoes that we tried to avoid. But of course it did give one a lot of time to think. And one thing that occurred to me, well, I'd felt so awful, not just for myself, but for the others who had run away, and for the sergeant, who of course got reduced to corporal pretty rapidly. But it had always been one of Monty's dicta that appealed to me, that if things go wrong, it's never the soldier's fault, only the officer's. And that was something that I believed, and I realised really that I'd had a rest. I mean, I'd been in palatial surroundings in a hospital. I'd had a fortnight without hearing a shot fired, and I'd had no time to get used to these men or them to get used to me. And this was an amalgamated platoon of two platoons that had a terrible experience. And had, despite that, they'd done already one major attack successfully and gone on, and that therefore it was to a degree my fault for underestimating it in advance, the state they were in, which I would have done if they'd been my ordinary platoon, and that really I should have had more care for them at the time, or briefed them better, or helped them more in setting this up. So I worried a bit about that. I mentioned how, I should mention how odd I found it that some people appeared to be, whether they were or not, totally nerveless, and even perhaps feeling it was something that, you know, it was an adventure that they enjoyed. And one of these was John Bodley, who was regarded by the tanks as being by far the most courageous man, particularly because he used to, as a carrier platoon commander, he used to deliberately put himself in the open to get himself fired on by anti-tank guns, which could be then identified. And he wrote these letters home, which were made into a book and put in the archives. And I remember he ended this period by saying, well, a great terrible thing about it was total boredom. We were at the top of a hill in intense heat and with masses of mosquitoes. And the real problem was this boredom gave you more time to think about home and wish you were back there. And that was the last thing he wrote. And of course, he sadly never made it back. But that, I think, was another thing. And he very quickly, when he was, sadly, he was killed on a mine, like me. He'd been on the mine courses after we'd been very callous about dealing with mines, and once one dealt with them, because even if you pulled up very well, have a second underneath, which would explode when you pull the top one out. And even though he'd been on that, he was eventually sadly killed by a single mine in the middle of nowhere. So you never known, it's all a lottery and more. So for me, it was really a whole year that, except for what I afterwards read about it, actually meant nothing in my mind, except I did remember a party at a hotel where all the old songs of the day were being sung, which I quite enjoyed. But then it was exactly a year before we missed out on Sicily entirely. And it was a year before we were finally sent to Italy. by which time the fighting had got quite a long way up Italy, well beyond Naples and so on. But I can't even remember where we sailed from, what the ship we went over was. And again, one thing I do remember was Naples, Vesuvius was erupting near Naples at the time we arrived, and not endangering Naples as a city. And we drove on through Naples on to some miles behind the front line, where we were in tented camps, and the fighting had by then reached Monte Cassino, and the unfortunate early battles there, which were defended this huge overlooking mountain so brilliantly that there were vast casualties on both sides, and Monte Cassino still untaken. So we did have a couple of practice, full divisional practices, where the one I remember is that I was the leading, I was the leading platoon, and I was told to take a bridge, and I did the attack straight at it, which was probably actually pretty silly, and one would normally have concurred with the army maxim that the longest way there is often the shortest way round. But anyway, that being so, the umpires, etc., had put all the troops out in long extended lines, expecting that was what we do. So I was very unpopular, because as there were no troops there, I captured the bridge immediately and ruined the exercise for half an hour while they reorganized everything. Otherwise, it was just, I remember a very friendly period that you tended to have between battles, and I was in a tent, I remember, with a Major Selway, who was a very interesting man, a very kindly man, and I was, had a very happy time there. There are many of my senior officers I remember happily, but there was one in the Cassino battle, which we finally joined, and just over, we got over the river, the Rapido. He was known fairly soon to all and sundry as, I won't give his name, but his nickname was Tat Nut, because he was always back at tactical headquarters, and when things got difficult back there, he started doing his nut. And having just got over the Rapido River, I remember being subjected to a volley of abuse and demands for impossible information while I and my wireless operator were lying in a ditch with tracer bullets streaming over us and knocking bits of mud out of the top of the ditch. So I was in no position to tell him what he wanted to know. You did have great differences in commanders, but an awful lot of mine seemed to be very sensible and brave people. So I was lucky that way. But having spent quite a time happily there, we were at last moved up to the front again, which by then was in an area which ran just behind the Rapido River, which went on and joined the Garigliano River, and we were back in a farmhouse, and because one was overlooked all the time by Monte Cassino, you couldn't do any movement by day. And for instance, once when most of another company was in a house overlooking the river, but of course were keeping very quiet themselves, because they could well have been shelled in the house if there was any indication they were there. So when I went up with a message for them, I had to crawl along a bit quietly, and it was something you didn't want to do anyway, because it was an area which was absolutely full of these horrible box mines, which were wooden mines which were wooden because they couldn't be detected by mine detectors, and there was just enough explosive in them to blow off your foot, not enough to kill you, which the German warlords thought was actually a better thing to do, because you were more trouble as an injured soldier who had to be removed from the battlefield than if you were killed. Very kind of them. So, you know, we were there also for the first time. We came under fire, which was very near our farmhouse, from the what we call, Germans called Nebelwerfers, but we call moaning minis, because they had huge mortar barrels, six of them I think, and very large mortar bombs that went in them. And they also had what the Germans specialised in, screaming devices, which were meant, as they did occasionally with mine, to disturb your nerves a bit. Because the Strukas, of course, all had this screaming device as they came down. And the Nebelwerfers did too. But fortunately, though they were bigger and more modern, for some reason they weren't nearly as accurate and therefore weren't, in some ways, or often nearly as dangerous as the old type mortars, which they used this great defence of mines, mortars and machine guns to great effect, particularly in country like Italy, which was easily defensible. So that was a new experience as we waited. And then we were told of this great new attack, when it was felt that previous attacks hadn't really had the strength to deal with, that overwhelming strength, to deal with such a huge formidable obstacle. And this both in the sort of supporting gunfire and in the number of troops involved was greatly increased number. So we were told about 2 nights before the attack was coming, and we were then moved up fairly close to the river, because the plan had been that when the attack started, our brilliant sappers would throw Bailey bridges across the river on the first night. But the Rapido River at least was living up to its name and was in flood, and the three bridges that they built in the first night were all washed away. So that was crisis, because our advanced troops had gone over in these little canvas boats and had taken the far side, but they were already under counterattack. And actually, had the Germans known it, they'd only got to put in a heavy tank counterattack, and we would have been driven right back there. So for the next night, the sappers were told just to make sure that one bridge got over at whatever the cost. And they put something like 200 sappers and 4 or 5 officers made this massive effort. And of course, for doing a bridge, you first of all have to find the bridge site, you have to clear that of mines, you then have to bring up the bridge in pieces in the dark, you then have to fit it together in the dark, you then have to get it pushed by a vehicle across the river, so it's no easy operation. But the sappers, and meanwhile we were sitting in this very close up to the river in an area which had actually been mined, and I wasn't particularly encouraged when 2 tanks got blown up by mines or had their tracks knocked off. And I sat there for a minute thinking, oh God, here we are getting all this and there's a whole German army on the other side. When will it ever stop? But I did eventually get to sleep and got woken up by a hammering of steel on steel. So, and what it turned out to be was a sapper officer hammering on a tank turret with the bottom of his revolver to wake the tank crew naturally sleeping inside to get ready for the... because in this, in building this bridge, first of all they came under a lot of mortar fire from the troops on the far bank, and then they came under machine gun fire, and some infantry had to go over and deal with that, and they had something like 80 casualties out of the 200. And when they got just two or three yards from the far bank, the only pushing vehicle they had was hit by a shell and destroyed. And sensibly, the senior officer rang back to the tanks and alerted this one by knocking. Eventually, a rather sleepy driver popped out. I'm not sure what he thought when he was asked to come and push a bridge over, which was something he'd never done. And the sapper said he was absolutely brilliant in the way he pushed the bridge the final few yards with his muzzle, the muzzle of his gun. And actually, by then, they were so determined to get something down that they left it down without the completion that there should have been for just let it go down, bang. And luckily, it survived. So the bridge was there in the morning, and the lead, it was about 4 o'clock that they finally got the bridge over, and the lead tank started going over, and we followed on behind, so we were going over the bridge fairly soon. And it was there I had another indication, with thanks to my brother, of how much better our field guns and 25-pounders were not just as guns, but in the way, the brilliant way they were used, because then the Germans were, I mean, they were great with their anti-tank guns and their tanks and their machine guns, but that, they seemed somehow not to be as clued up with. And so there were the Germans seeing everything. For the infantry attack, they'd put smoke canisters all along the river, so in the early stage, it was all covered in a smoke screen, but by now the tanks were going, the smoke had dispersed, and yet their guns never hit the bridge, the tanks, or us. And we then went at about 2 miles, the Germans had been pushed back, and so we followed the tanks up this track, seeing knocked-out anti-tank guns and so on, and German prisoners coming back. And we eventually got to a T-junction, which was the limit of which we regarded as fully occupied. And the T-junction was just a small lane with a high bank, fortunately, on the far side, which is where the Germans were, and a tall hedge as well. And so we formed up there for quite a time with considerable shelling, but by then there was a huge, huge queue of trucks and vehicles waiting to go down, because you went down one at a time. You took it in turns to dice for death with a dash down the road. But the whole time the Germans fired at us and at my truck, but they never adjusted to the truck speed, and the shells always fell behind. And they never had an officer clued enough to think, well, if these keep coming down, we're ranged on that, and there must be a whole mass of, why don't we have a shot at them and see if fires start or whatever, and they never did it. And so we went down. My job was to go down and then go off to the right and reconnoitre a bridge that had been long blown up by the Germans and so on. As I say, I eventually ended in a ditch with German machine guns being fired just over my head and massive demands of the wireless to do things I couldn't do. But once the machine gunning stopped, I went up the hill in search of our forward troops, and because I was then second in command of my old platoon. And when I found the platoon, we were well up a small hill, but with trees all around and bushes. And so I put out our best shot with a sniper's rifle, somewhere where he had a good view. And if he saw anything, he could alert us. And sure enough, just before at dawn, he came racing back to report that he'd seen a couple of Germans washing only about 100 yards away from him. So I said, well, did you get both of them? Oh, no, he said, I couldn't possibly shoot at people who were just washing. It wouldn't be fair. I had to tell him war wasn't fair. And in an hour later, those who might kill him and me. And I don't know whether it was the same man, but in the morning there was an attack up a nearby gentle hill, at the top of which there was just what looked like a hedge, but which turned out to be another lane, a sunken lane, with a lot of Germans dug in, and with which their bazooka, anti-infantry, anti-tank weapons, with bombs really, were much superior to our little anti-tank ones, which really weren't terribly effective and didn't have much of a range. And they knocked out one of the tanks, and before it was taken they also killed the Lieutenant Bomford, who was leading the attack. So it may be that the two we let go were there knocking off some of us, which one never knows. And one or two of this vast casino battle was raging, with the hills being stormed and the Poles doing a wonderful job in attacking from a slightly different direction. And though they had terrible casualties, they inflicted terrible casualties too, and finally took the monastery. But this was before they'd got the monastery, and so the observers were still there. And so we were overlooked, but another instance of how poor their shooting tend to be compared to ours. I was told to lead part of the battalion to a forming up area and get them undercover as far as I could there. And I was going, having had my good map reading sessions back at Tidworth and compass bearings and all the rest, I was pretty good at finding my way. But on this occasion, the Lombardy plain below Monte Cassino was crisscrossed with lanes, and it was pretty difficult to see on the map which was what. But I soon came up against two military policemen who immediately stopped me. And I said, you know, I want to go. No, you're not allowed to go on. You've got to go to this lane on the right. So eventually, you know, with everything queuing up behind me, nothing else to do but to agree. I mean, they got their orders, they were given to me, I'd got to do it. So I went the way I didn't think I ought to go, and sure enough, I had been right. I mean, the other way may have been worse, but I'm quite right with this one, because we soon entered another of these sunken lanes, and while I was going cautiously around the corner, there were bullets crisscrossing in front of me and infantry waving to me to go away. And there we had the whole half of the battalion in this sunken lane, including portees, which were cumbersome vehicles which carried proper anti-tank guns. So getting them turned round in the sunken lane was a terrible job. And the Germans obviously seen us, because they fired fairly close, but they never got anything into the sunken lane. And no trucks were hit or damaged. And the only casualty was this man I'd mentioned, John Bodley, who was such an incredibly courageous chap. And he'd sprung up on the top of it to help the trucks back and so on. And one of the fairly near shells wounded him. And he was carried away on a stretcher, giving the V sign. And then came back later, of course. So eventually I got everything backed and did manage to go my way and find where the forming up area was meant to be. And there were some huge German dugouts which had been abandoned, but the area where we were harbouring the truck soon began to be shelled, so it seemed very convenient to have these huge dugouts into which one could get. But unfortunately, I've always suffered both from asthma and from claustrophobia. And after about an hour and a half in this darkness and terrible, and of course they were so huge, these dugouts, you couldn't actually hear anything, and so I just couldn't stick it anymore. I went out and lay in this field that was being shelled. That was, by then, the Poles had taken Monte Cassino. The Germans were in retreat, but not far, because there was then what was the Germans then called the Dora Line, but which we called the Aquino Line, because it was based on Aquino. And the Germans had previous called the Adolf Hitler Line, which was rapidly changed, but it looked like being overrun. And the rest of the Hanlin that evening did patrols that very nearly got through, and I don't think the Dora Line had been fully occupied, but they were too small a force to get through completely. And the following night, the Canadian division or divisions was put in for a major attack, and we were told to follow on in the morning when they cleared the way. And that was really the most depressing battlefield scene I ever saw. And yet, looking back, well, they paid a great price for it by the courageous way they and the Churchill tanks attacked. They did break through in one day, whereas Monte Cassino, it had been attack after attack, and over 3 months the casualties were vast, whereas here they had just one lot of casualties, and then the Germans were forced to retreat. So, first we passed the wood where they'd obviously formed up, and this was rather like the pictures of First World War woods with just shattered trees and bare bark and lots of bodies about. And that had obviously been their forming up area. There was then this 400 or 500 yards of almost like a meadow, at the end of which were these huge Panther tank turrets, not on tanks, but cemented into the ground, so that there were obviously openings at the back where they came in, and then they had a tank turret which was very difficult to see. They had the toughest armour in a tank. They had all their guns and machine guns operative. And so the field in front was lined with knocked-out Churchill tanks and with a sort of sea of white-tipped spikes, white-tipped sticks, which were marking out another body, or perhaps, but I think by then it was certainly another body, because they were also used to mark casualties for the stretcher bearers to see. And as we went past, in a slightly depressed mood, we were told our task was to take a bridge about a mile further on under at the top of a little river called the Melfa River. And as we went past these tank turrets and so on, there were loudspeakers saying, be careful, there are snipers in the trees ahead, and so on. So it wasn't a very cheer. And when we got near the Melfa, of course, we harboured the rest of the company. And my company commander, Jim Lonsdale, took me forward to see if we could see anything about the bridge. And we were fortunately about 300 yards away, because we didn't know how well it was held, or peering through glasses, when the most enormous artillery stonk came down, fortunately on all the edges of the river, which they'd obviously been sighted on, preparatory to an attack. And this was obviously, which they often did, firing off all their remaining shells before they retreated, partly so they weren't left to us, partly in case they scored a few hits. So while Jim stood upright looking through his glasses, I had a great desire to lie flat on the ground, but obviously you couldn't do it with your company card and seeming totally under move. The good thing was that when we attacked the bridge, there wasn't anybody there, so that launched us. And then I had this odd night thereafter, that after over that we got orders near dusk to cross a quite sizable river at a ford, which was marked on the map, and set up, take the far bank if it was held, and set up there. So Jim had us together, and the platoon commanders, in a ruined house by torchlight, pointing out where we were to go on the map. And off we set, and we finally came to this ford, and we splashed across it with some illumination from shells bursting close by. But happily, when we got to the far bank, there appeared to be no one there. So Jim went on a quarter of a mile or so, and then established our headquarters there with him and me and the wireless operators and so on, and wireless back that mission accomplished. While the other three platoons, one peeled off to the right where there didn't seem to be anything, and two to the left where it looked like there were houses or habitation or something. So hardly we got settled in, and there was a massive explosion on the